Remaker's Mark for Shame, number one, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Remaker's Mark. Here we are embarking upon our first For Shame episode. We've talked about this a little bit before, but we're going to be doing something new here, and we're pretty excited about it. With me, as always, are my friends Andy Wicks. Andy, how are you doing tonight?
Very well, thank you.
Excellent. Jeremy Nilsson, how are things in your world?
What up? Oh, great.
Oh, I'll take a what up. I'm cool with that. Whoop. Lee Having Shame, how are you this fine evening?
I'm doing well.
Wonderful. And Mark Josting, how are things in your little sphere of the universe?
I'm super drunk.
Excellent. No change there. Very good. My name is Kyle Delahunt. I will be your host once again. And again, we are embarking on something new here. This is the first in our series that we're calling For Shame. To give a little bit of background about this, we basically have a lot of shame that we want to share with the world. So this is going to be sort of like therapy. I actually told the guys this is about film education, but we're actually going to be doing an intervention about Andy. Andy, no, I'm just kidding. Aww. There's no interventions here. It would have been fun, though, to see where it went. No, so this is, in fact, more of a film education sort of thing for us. So in all of our film discussions, which we have had many, of which you've been the witness of some, and outside of that, we've had quite a few others, we have sort of discovered, you know, there's a lot of classic movies or what are, you know, quote unquote classic, which, you know, I think are probably there for a reason, considered classics for a reason, that we as a whole group have not seen. Now, we're not beating ourselves up for that, but rather we thought, you know what? I think it's our chance to remedy that. So this series, the For Shame series, shame on us. So not shame on you, the listener, not shame on the filmmakers, but for shame us for not having seen these movies. So the first movie that we are going to tackle is Andy's pick. So Andy, why don't you tell us what your pick is and why you chose it?
I am here to confess my sins. No, I'm just first in the list. I chose Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Honestly, I chose it because it was the highest ranked film on the list we were referencing that none of us have seen. So I thought, hey, let's start there.
Start at the top. So the list that you referenced, mention that. No, that was my bad. We looked at, I think, the Sight and Sound poll and the AFI Top 100 poll and used that to create a spreadsheet where we then went down the line and noted which movies we had not seen from those. And then we basically are choosing from those the movies that the least of us have seen. So this is an opportunity for all of us to educate ourselves as a whole. So sorry for that, Andy.
No, that's okay.
Fill that in a little bit.
The more you know. So I think we were going to choose movies that one or none of us had seen. And this is the first one that none of us have seen. Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. I'll tell you what I know about it.
Excellent.
There we are.
Excellent.
No, I know a little bit more than that. Actor.
James Stewart.
Jimmy Stewart. God, I can never remember his name. Jimmy Stewart is in the movie. I believe he plays Mr. Smith. Rumor has it he goes to Washington.
That's what I'm told.
Supposedly. I believe that he becomes a politician, is a politician, changes the way Washington works, saves the day. If my assumptions are true, I also, because that's part of what I based it on too, honestly, I wouldn't mind seeing a picture where things... Like, it's kind of a feel-good movie about Washington. I feel like we could use that. Like, oh, see, the system can work. So
yeah, that's fair. So what I know of it is that it is a Frank Capra movie, he being the director of It's a Wonderful Life. So I am expecting an appropriate degree of schmaltz along with it, being another Capra-Jimmy Stewart pairing. So that's really all I know, other than what you mentioned, that Jimmy Stewart is in it and that involves politics somehow. So I'm curious to see what it actually is.
Have any of us seen it, or is this the one that none of us have seen?
No, none of us have seen this one.
None of us have seen this one.
Perfect. Nope. What I know about Mr. Smith Goes to Washington is based on two parodies of Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, one of which is called Beyond Blunderdome, an episode of The Simpsons, where Homer...
Is that with Mel Gibson?
Yep, Homer helps to rewrite Mr. Smith Goes to Washington's remake with Mel Gibson.
I think I've seen that one.
And the end of it is just a giant bloodbath in the the Senate chambers or whatever. Yeah. And somebody gets stabbed with the flag, I think. And the second one, and probably a little bit more apropos, is called Mr. Lisa Goes to Washington, also a Simpsons episode, and a much better Simpsons episode.
Oh, where that's a good one. Yeah.
Lisa wins an essay contest and goes to Washington and becomes completely disillusioned with government when she realizes how corrupt it is. And I think it probably follows the plot of Mr. Smith Goes to Washington a little bit better. So no, I'm excited to see how many. Yep. So I think I get, like you guys, I think the general gist of it's there. I'm hoping that it's not too overly cheesy as I Know It's a Wonderful Life feels to me. But I do know that what people say is one of the greatest sort of soliloquies or speeches in film is the end of this movie. So I'm excited to finally see that in its entirety. I've seen clips and bits and pieces of it, but I think his filibuster at the end of the movie is one of what people say one of the best speeches in film. So
I'm ready to be moved.
I'm excited to see it. Yeah.
There's a sidebar on that. Mr. Lisa Goes to Washington has one of the funniest scenes where Homer has to ask someone what VIP stands for.
And I don't remember that.
Oh my gosh.
Let's see if we can find it.
I can't explain it. Please link it. It's just great.
All right.
Also one of the many episodes of The Simpsons where Abraham Lincoln talks. So, where the Lincoln Memorial comes to life and convinces Lisa that government's okay.
As does Thomas Jefferson Memorial, but it's not as effective.
Yeah, that's right.
Nice. Lee or Mark, anything that you want to add to that at all?
You guys apparently know way more about the movie than I do. I just knew it.
Which is not saying a lot.
It was starring Jimmy Stewart. And it was a Frank Capra movie, and it's regarded as one of the greatest movies ever made.
I think so, on our list, it was ranked in the top 10, maybe?
Yeah, probably. Like
six or seven, maybe. Yep.
It's way up there.
I will be curious to find out or to see just what it is about it that makes it such a timeless movie.
Yeah.
From its plot and from the little that we do know about it, it doesn't strike me as something that is really out of the ordinary that much. Although you look at some of the other movies that, you know, Casablanca was kind of the same thing. Like if you, on paper, that's just a run of the mill, you know, throwaway movie turned into a masterpiece somehow or another. So maybe this is kind of along that same lines.
Yeah, and you can really say the same thing about any film. I mean, if you just read a plot synopsis, I mean, very few movies are going to be very interesting just on paper. But as I like to remind people, art is not in the content, it's in the presentation.
Well put.
Thank you.
I'm going to correct myself. This movie on the AFI Top 100 is ranked number 27, and I was also wrong. It's not the highest ranked movie that none of us have seen, but it's the one that I chose. That's all.
Excellent. That works. That's all it needs to be.
Fact checking.
Indeed. So now none of us having seen this, we are going to pause here. We're not literally going to watch it right now, so time is not going to stop for us, and we're going to watch it. But we're all going to watch it independently. Maybe we'll hang out and watch it together. I don't know. We'll see. The next time you hear from us, we'll probably put some sort of pithy music in here in the meantime. And then the next time you hear from us, in hopefully just a few seconds, we will have seen the movie and are going to discuss it further. So, on to that.
And now, before the next show starts, let's enjoy an intermission. You'll find our snack bar chock full of good things to eat and drink. Tasty, tempting hot dogs, thirst-quenching soft drinks, fresh, crunchy popcorn, a complete assortment of delicious candy, and a full line of cigarettes.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat.
And we're back. So now, after that jaunty break there, we have...
It sure was jaunty.
We, as a collective whole, have watched Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, our first For Shame pick, and now we are going to talk about it. And the way that we're going to talk about it is like this. Hey, fellas, what did you think about Mr. Smith Goes to Washington? Did you like it? Did you not like it? We're going to talk about some specific things with the movie, but let's just get general impressions first. So what do you guys think? Did you enjoy this? Did you think this was worthy of a AFI Top 100 slot?
Golly gee, willikers. I like this movie. I really did.
What's up, Paperboy?
Yeah.
Some real quality, AC. I think it was generally deserving of a Top 100, and that's it really was a pretty tight story. It it was moving, and gosh darn it, golly gee whiz, and such.
It's Capra ad is Capra est.
Yeah, we're gonna get to that on the tone side of things a bit, but yeah, absolutely.
It's a timeless tale. It's a timeless tale.
Yeah, for sure.
I did enjoy it a lot. It was a lot more entertaining than I was expecting.
Yeah, you never quite know. You know, I knew, again, we talked a little bit about what we knew about this, which wasn't a whole lot. None of us had seen it. So we knew it was politics-y, and that it had Jimmy Stewart in it, and that it was Frank Capra. I almost always say Franz Capra, and then I know that's wrong.
That's Kafka.
And then I almost say Frank Kafka, but none of those are right. Frank Capra. So it is. We knew it was a Capra, but we didn't really know too much. And yeah, I thought it was really entertaining. It was a little weird at times, a little messy at times, but ultimately, I think really moving. I think it could have seen a stronger editing focus, maybe a little bit. Yeah. But all in all, I thought it was pretty enjoyable. It's so hard. I mean, I think we'll see as we watch more of these, we'll see more of an idea of what these top 100 movies are, you know, what their tone is, you know, sort of historically why they are great at that time. You know, I don't remember what year this movie was made, but maybe we watched something that was maybe a year after that and it feels really antiquated compared to this. So then suddenly this looks really forward thinking, really advanced from a filmmaking perspective, etc. So, you know, we'll see and we'll learn more as we go along, which was, again, part of this idea. Jared, what about you? What were your impressions?
I liked it about as much as I like your average movie. I wasn't blown away by it. I did think that the story was a pretty timeless sort of classic tale told, which I think a lot of the sort of top 100 movies kind of have that quality of timelessness. And so in that respect, I thought that it was something you couldn't really pinpoint a year that this took place in, or, well, I guess less so when it was made. You can kind of figure that out, but I mean, this could just as easily have taken place now, and still would have been basically the same type of story.
I think that's played out in modern references like the Simpsons episode Mr. Lisa Goes to Washington, which is probably where most of us are the most familiar with this movie before actually seeing
probably,
it.
Probably, yeah.
But that's to show, like, it's a modern take on this tale, and it still was, you know, it's obviously a different setting, but I think it was just as effective as the original was. I think that, to your point, Jared, these old classic movies tend to have, you know, just the overarching human themes, and this is kind of it's almost a David and Goliath kind of a story. The sticking to your guns and the, you know, sticking to your principles in the face of overwhelming odds and things like that.
Yeah, I think it painted in broad brushes, but I think it painted in less broad brushes than many movies of its time. You know, I think it painted in broad brushes in a very focused environment, in a very focused position. You know, I mean, I think having defined itself very strongly as a politics-related movie, that sets a more narrow scene than just a Christmas movie, right? So if you're thinking of It's a Wonderful Life or something like that. So, you know, I think it did speak universally and did so successfully, but I think it was focused enough that it kept it interesting and not too broad.
Yeah. One of the things that I thought of when I was watching this was another modern parallel, and that is the movie Evan Almighty.
Yep.
Yeah. And obviously that one has the Noah story component and, you know, God. Even the premise of the crooked politicians is pretty much exactly the same. Like, there is a dam built for, you know, whatever crooked politician economic reasons are. I forget exactly. I'm not
the
sure.
Machine.
What exactly I'm not sure it was really that clear in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. But anyway, it is the same premise. And I still felt that, like, even Morgan Freeman and Steve Carell presences I felt Mr. Smith Goes to Washington was a better film.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Now, that was the Steve Carell one you said, right? Not Bruce Almighty, but Evan Almighty?
Yeah, Evan Almighty was Steve Carell.
Got it. Okay.
The other one that is a pretty blatant modern retelling of the same story is The Distinguished Gentleman, which is an Eddie Murphy movie from early 2000s, where he basically is kind of a con man, and he gets elected to Congress basically because he has the same name as a congressman that died. And so he
it's like the Big Lebowski meets politics.
More or less, yeah. So he basically just gets in because people are like, oh, we always vote for this guy. We should just, vote for this guy again. And it's a different person. So he gets in and he's just kind of the shyster. And he realizes at the beginning, he kind of falls in with that same crowd of, getting the bribes and whatnot to vote certain ways or pass certain bills or whatever. And then he kind of realizes that what he's doing is actually affecting people. And he was appointed to this position to make change and to be the voice of people that didn't have a voice. And so ultimately brings down this corrupt machine of government by turning it on its head. It's much more of a comedy than this one. Although I was surprised at how funny this movie was at points, but,
Me too.
But it really was. And I think that there's probably tons of examples of sort of the lone wolf Boy Scout guy, turning the corruption back on itself, the kind of not quite whistleblower story, but in that same vein.
Yeah. So some of the sort of focuses that we had when just doing a brief discussion ahead of time of what we wanted to talk about, so as not to completely wing this, but just kind of mostly wing this, one of the things that came up was sort of the filmmaking side of things and sort of the Capra-ness of it. Now, how many of you have seen It's a Wonderful Life?
I have. I'm raising my hand, but I also felt I should speak.
Doesn't work as well on podcasts, but yeah. I appreciate it.
Yeah. I'm not raising my hand.
I am not raising my hand either. Anybody else raising their hand?
Nope.
Interesting. Well, might have to do a Capra double duo or a double dipper here. So, I think what to me the Capra means, if you were to say a Capra-esque movie, it would be a moral-based story, sort of a little over the top with its emotional effectiveness or obviousness, but very well made. So, I don't know. Is that what you guys kind of came in with, a sort of a preconceived notion about what that would mean for this movie?
Mine was a little more Hallmark-based.
Okay, yeah.
Or a little Hallmark, a little Thomas Kinkade, very, very blatant, tugging at your emotional heartstrings.
Yeah.
To get their point across. Those are my preconceived notions on Capra.
Yep.
Naive optimism.
Yeah, that's a good one.
I think those are all fair.
Yeah, and I think that, I think this movie... it did nothing to shut those preconceived notions down, but I feel it was not so obvious. It was not quite so emotional, heartstring tuggy. You know what I mean? I feel like this was maybe the best version of that it could be. I think there are certain filmmakers that you know what you're going to get when you watch their movies, whether light or dark or what have you. And I think he's on the lighter side of that. But I thought, I thought it was as balanced as it could be given his tendency towards those techniques, if you will.
I think it was pretty balanced, but I would chalk it up to the subject matter more than anything else. I mean, it felt super, super hokey. And I'll just give a couple examples. Like you have Jeff Smith going to Washington. He just kind of wanders off and gets on a tour bus when he's supposed to be going to his office. He's supposed to be going to Capitol Hill. And instead, he just wanders off.
Hey, look, there's the Capitol.
Yeah.
And I think that's literally a line from the movie.
Yeah. They make him into a Boy Scout, I mean, literally.
Yes.
How old does one need to be in order to sit in the Senate? Like 35, maybe?
For a presidential 30? Election. I don't know about for the Senate. It's a good question.
I think there is an age limit, it's... it's not like he's 12. I mean, this is a grown man. He's been around for a while. And he does act like a little kid. I mean, he's super naive, to the point where I feel it would be unrealistic, especially for somebody that is as much of a social force as Jeff Smith is supposed to be.
Yeah, I feel like that was him being a little bit of a pawn, though. I mean, the newspaper stuff, like the pictures of him plugging his nose, like I think he sort of knew what was expected and he was willing to be the pawn, but I think they went even farther than what he thought they would, both the media and what his sort of colleagues or the people that brought him there expected him to be. So, some of that was, again, painted in very broad brushes, but I didn't feel like that was him as much as that was the story that they wanted to tell about him. I don't know. That's true. Sure. It doesn't feel like a perfect balance or it doesn't feel like he's not accountable, but I feel like he's a little bit less accountable than maybe that you felt it.
Yeah. I think that basically Capra goes for super high morality and super high heartstringy every time, but with a film about American politics, it doesn't come off quite as hallmarky as a film about reflecting on your life.
Yeah. Yep, that's true. That's a very good call. Absolutely.
Going back to our earlier question about age, you need to be 30 or older to be a senator. And Jimmy Stewart happened to be 31 when this movie was released.
Yeah. It's so funny. Like, having seen a few Jimmy Stewart movies, not a lot, mind you, but a few, you just sort of assume that he goes from like 21 to 50. Like there's really nothing in between there. And it was really interesting seeing like a younger Jimmy Stewart. I think he did really well, but it was just so strange. I was like, wow,
yeah,
he's got black hair.
He looked very young.
Yeah, he did look very young.
That's what being a pilot in World War II will do to you.
Oh, yeah. So that was after this?
This was just before the war, and then all those other bigger roles that he's known for were post-World War II.
Yeah, so this was 1939, right?
Yep.
Yep.
Wow, man. Yeah, good call.
Can you imagine Jimmy Stewart's voice coming over on over the radio on your fighter pilot, your fighter jet?
And man.
They're like, Mr. Smith?
I can't shake him.
You've got a bogey on your six.
Where's my cover? Wait a minute.
Was it that Sean Connery or was that
Sean Connery with a tiny little bit of Christopher Walken, I think. which is my entire range of celebrity impressions.
Yeah, yeah, I don't know. I don't know what it is, but somehow every time I try any accent, it automatically goes to Sean Connery.
No, I don't see any fault with that, really. I think that's perfectly fine. On the filmmaking side of things, I don't know if this is a Capra staple, having not, I don't think, seen any other of his movies, but there were a whole lot of montages in this movie. There was a very overly patriotic one, including one where it showed like an eagle in the middle of it. I was like, oh, come on. I actually said that out loud. I said, oh, come on out loud. Like it was him sort of trying to do his best. And then there was like a picture of an eagle and the flag. I was like, oh come on, guys, seriously. But then there was the one I just wrote in the notes. What in the hell is with the press punching montage?
Seriously,
did you guys get that? I didn't understand that. I thought he was like having a dream and living out the fantasy of punching press.
I thought it was his imagination, but no, he actually did it, and somehow he actually didn't get arrested, and somehow somehow that wasn't the thing that got in all the newspapers.
Yeah, that was really weird. That one I had no idea where that came from. So
yeah, like I get it. Like it's supposed to establish his character and the naivete. It's just he's starting to realize how cruel life can be on Capitol Hill. And he's upset that he was so blatantly misquoted and misportrayed. But to go around punching all the members of the press, like literally tracking them down.
There are ways to portray someone as a fighter that are slightly less obvious than showing him punching people. Like you just show that he's like doesn't give up and he doesn't quit and he sticks strong in the face of challenge, instead of just like, I'm angry, I'm going to stick up for myself by punching the people who wrote bad things about me. Like that. Yeah, that was really strange.
It's very
entertaining.
Strange.
Maybe he needed to punch 12 people to get his face punching Boy Scout badge.
Oh, there you go. Interesting. I didn't know that. I'll look into that. I'll see if I can find that.
I would love to see the graphic on that badge.
I was just thinking that exact same thing. I would love to see that badge. Nice. So it's kind of speaking of the tone side of things, I think we all were a little bit surprised with how lighthearted it was. And Jerry, you touched on that a little bit. Do you want to talk about what you thought about that or specific instances of that?
Well, I was generally just surprised that it bordered or fell into comedy as much as it did. And I guess I didn't realize just how old this movie was either. 1939 and pre-World War II kind of came out of nowhere for me, but like it had a lot of kind of vaudevillian moments for me. The one that I guess I would touch on is early on in the film when the older senator who's retiring, or the guy who has to come up with who the new senator is going to be, is trying to decide between
the governor.
Is that who that was?
Yeah, that's the governor.
He was trying to decide between the corrupt pawn and the goody two shoes guy, and going back and forth. And then he's sitting down to dinner with his apparently baseball team sized family
and all approximately equal aged children.
Yeah. Right. And then they just go into this, it feels like an Abbott and Costello routine with his kids, just rapid fire dialogue, just one after the other. And it's just completely phony and scripted and just ridiculous. And it totally feels vaudevillian. And
I was waiting for them to break out into a song in that scene.
Exactly. All of a sudden, a bunch of orphans from the cast of Annie come in, and they're doing something or whatever. But
very much felt like that.
There was a lot of little moments like that where you're like, this is just weird, and it in some ways it took away from the seriousness of the topic, but then in other ways it's like made the movie a lot more entertaining for me at the same time too. So I don't know, I was just kind of surprised that it was as sort of wacky, nutty as it was at times.
Agreed, yeah.
I loved the characters of Saunders and Diz.
Yeah, totally.
And especially the scene where they're drunk proposing to each other. Uh-huh. That back and forth that they have was just so, so funny, and kind of seems a little bit tangential to the plot to a point. I mean, there was a reason why she was as upset and drunk as she was, but just that scene was so funny and... That took me by surprise, because I was not expecting that in this kind of a film.
Yeah, me too. And she did an awesome drunk.
Yeah, she did. Yeah.
That's a hard thing to pull off for actors.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah.
I really enjoyed her performance. I think hers was my favorite in the film.
Yeah, I agree. Mm, me too. She was my favorite too.
That's a tough role, and it wasn't... She wasn't a... I wouldn't call her a strong female character, but I think she had a lot of strength in her. But I think, a lot of movies of the time didn't allow super strong female characters, but I thought she portrayed her really well. I thought she was really interesting and really funny, and I like that she really pushed back to him. Like he would suggest something and she would kind of, they would sort of volley back and forth, and I thought that was maybe my favorite part of the movie, is their just sort of interactions and exchanges back and forth. I really like that. All right. And then the other thing that we talked about certainly with this is the politics of the film. So, there's a whole lot of this related to politics, whether explicitly or just the world around it. I think the fact that they talked about corruption is just an assumed thing. They frame the movie as something that it is not a surprise that what happens happens. So, I am not a good history person, so I can't speak a lot to the politics at the time. Are there any history nerds out there who would wish to talk about sort of where the U.S. was at that time?
I'm not very good with this part of American history, but I think it's
the
probably
Roosevelt years.
It's probably both fair and jaded to say that this level of, I don't know about corruption, but backroom politics has always been around.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep, that's true.
No matter what the form of government, no matter what the culture, there are always people in positions of power that seek to exert more influence.
Yeah.
There's
an article on The Dissolve talking about sort of the politics of Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, and I think this sentence sums it up really nicely. In a general sense, it's straightforward Capra populism, prizing the gumption and decency of ordinary folks over the cynicism and inefficiency of the machine. I think that's a pretty good encapsulation of it. So the power of the people versus the power of the politic.
I was both bored and entertained by the minutiae of daily political life in Congress that they went into. You know, there's the scene where Saunders is explaining to Smith how a bill is made and it goes through committee and, you know, all the processes that it must go through.
I love that scene.
But then there's also just scenes about like his first day in the Senate chamber, and there's all of these kind of rites and rituals that it seems that go on, and he's just kind of staring around trying to follow it all that kind of seem unimportant or outdated or antiquated or things like that. But it's all part of the, you know, the ritual and the show of it. But I really also thought it was interesting that they very intentionally never identify the state in which he is from. They also never identify the president.
Yep.
You know, they stay within the Senate chamber, you know, for any of the political things that happen. So I thought that was very, they were very specific to certain aspects of government and very vague to other aspects of it. So that you, excuse me, they focused on a few certain elements and kind of left the rest of it to, you could fill in the blanks, you know.
And I don't think that they explicitly note who involve or who belongs to which party either.
Yep, they do.
So he is never noted as a Democrat or a Republican. It's just, it's really just like Joseph Campbell stuff, right? Like the good guy or the bad guy, you know? And it, you, at first it's ambiguous, and then it gets clearer and clearer who the bad guy or bad guys are.
You get a sense, I think, as close, as far as they go is that I think there's a point at which the Senate majority leader sides against Jefferson Smith. So that's kind of the only clue that you get, like, that he's in the minority.
Yeah.
But
yeah, that's true.
What you don't ever know, again, is that which side of the, you know, is he left-leaning, right-leaning, whatever? Is he the same party as the other senator? Is he not? They never go into those details. But at the same time, I didn't feel like it was, like, I didn't feel like I was wanting those details. I didn't care. I thought it was still a great portrayal of the political machine, and that was really all that I needed.
Yeah, it, that goes to show when universality is a huge strength, because you don't come in with preconceived notions of like Republican Senator Smith or Democratic Senator, because then the viewer puts their viewpoint on there, you know, as opposed to just saying Senator. And then you start with a pretty flat palette. You start with a pretty blank slate, which is nice. I think I appreciate that they did that.
Unless you're an anarchist.
True. Then you just hate everything.
Well, and Republican and Democratic senators in 1939 probably meant a lot different things to the movie-going public than they did today.
Yeah.
There weren't any Whigs still around, were there?
No, I don't think so.
That was late 1800s is when that flipped over.
I thought that was before that. Abraham Lincoln was a Whig.
Abraham Lincoln was a Whig. His first term he was a Whig.
He was a Whig first.
He was a Whig first.
Wow.
Interesting.
Oh, I was just going to say, back to the history of the movie, I was, after I watched it, I read a couple of things on it as well. And a couple of things that I found interesting was it was not allowed to be shown in Hitler's Germany, Mussolini's Italy, or Stalin's Russia, which I guess is not overly surprising. Also not overly surprising is that members of government really weren't big fans of the movie and actually tried to get it not banned, but they tried to suppress it a little bit.
Interesting.
And they actually ended up passing some type, I'd have to go back and look at it, but they ended up passing a law that supposedly was kind of a retaliation of this movie coming out that kind of dissolved studios owning theaters.
Oh, interesting. So the Mr. Smith Goes to Washington Leaves Washington bill?
Exactly.
Interesting. Sort of tying back to the governmental procedure, parliamentary procedure, what have you, I found it interesting, having watched House of Cards, that in season 2, I think it is, there's a big plot point involving calling quorum and, you know, sort of forcing a vote based on that. It doesn't go to a filibuster like it did in this, but I thought it was pretty interesting. Like, wait a minute, I've seen this before. And so, you know, to see how much government might have changed, and the corruption is still there, certainly, but the practices have changed a bit. They are much the same now as they were, 75 years ago.
I feel like that we should probably, as nerds that we all are, make mention at least of the episode of Parks and Rec where there's a filibuster to stop a bill from getting passed.
Patton Oswalt, right?
Yeah, Patton Oswalt comes on because he's a reenactor of this historic holiday that is just ridiculous and kind of doesn't do anything, and nobody really likes it anymore. And so they decide that they want to pass a law that they don't have to celebrate it anymore. And he comes in and filibusters to stop them from voting. And his filibuster is all about the Avengers and Star Wars and Marvel and DC. And it, the original YouTube clip, which I'm sure you can probably still find, and maybe Kyle, you can put it on there, but it's literally him talking for like 9 minutes straight with no cut, no nothing, just him talking nerd speak, and it's pretty phenomenal.
Yeah. It's awesome. Just waiting to hear cut, and they never did. They just kept going, and so he just kept going. Like, he was expecting it to be much shorter, and he just like went with it, which is one of the many reasons why Patton Oswalt is a flipping genius.
Yes. One of the reasons that he deserves to be on Marvel's Agents of Shields.
Yes.
Shields, plural.
Shields. It's possessive now.
Yes.
It belongs to them.
And it possesses Patton Oswalt.
What else about the politics of this? It seems like there were some maybe some qualms about the power of the Boy Scout newspaper, maybe.
It's read by millions of people, according to the governor's kids.
Millions of boys.
Millions of boys and all their parents.
I was a little shocked that a truck ran over a bunch of them to stop them from delivering papers.
Yeah, they reference it very briefly. Jeez. Like, I think Saunders is talking to Diz about that right after it happened, like after that montage happens.
Like, boys are getting injured all over the state.
Yeah, how she wants them to stop because boys are getting injured now.
Oh, I never tracked that. Should have stopped, but I didn't know why.
Yeah, a very little quick kind of comment. But yeah, we were noting that you have what's the main bad guy, Taylor, who apparently controls
James Taylor, oddly.
Yeah. Who knew, such a jerk, who apparently controls all the newspapers and has influence over the other newspapers to keep all of the news about the filibuster out of the newspapers of his state. But yet the boy rangers, not scouts, produce their own little pamphlet in apparently sufficient quantities to rival the production of the other newspapers. But they seem like they all of the parties involved produced multiple prints or multiple issues of a newspaper for a filibuster that lasted 24 hours.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Like, that was a very fast news turnaround there.
Yeah, the news cycle back then was very aggressive.
Holy cow.
Yes.
And it was an hourly newspaper.
Yeah, no kidding.
And is it at all strange that a boy's newspaper, like a pamphlet, could have that much influence at all? You know,
or that much printing production power?
Well, yeah. Uh-huh. And then, like, held up against every newspaper in the state, the generic state. It would be like a, it'd be less significant than a blogger these days.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't really hold up to scrutiny, but it was awfully effective in the moment. Like, that whole sequence I thought was totally over the top, and I was like, all right, I'm going to let this go. This is pretty entertaining. Yeah.
Parades for both sides, and then big, like...
And in the end, the Boys Ranger media effort was for naught.
That's funny. I guess I never thought about that.
Yeah, that what came of it was many, many bags and bundles of newspapers and telegrams being marched into the Senate that all condemned Jeff Smith.
Right. And those were forged, yes? That was the assumption that those were not...
It may not have been... I didn't get the impression they were forged. It was just you only saw one side of the debate.
Yeah. I guess I assumed that that they were at least filtered. But there was nothing really mentioned about it. Although we knew it was that, judging by Jeff's reaction, they were probably bad news.
Yeah.
I think it just went to I thought it was very interesting that they talk about when Jeff Smith kind of makes his position clear about the being opposed to the dam, when they put the full might of that Taylor political machine against him, how rapidly things happen. Suddenly he's the owner of all this land. There's a deed, there's contracts, there's all these documents that show that he, you know, that just kind of like popped out of nowhere, you know, experts and things like that testifying, and all of a sudden, you kind of wonder, it made me wonder if things like that really did happen, if they can still happen. I'm sure they still could happen. You see it a lot in Hollywood, but you got to kind of wonder. It's like what's the movie? Wag the Dog. Anyone ever seen that? Mm-hmm. Dustin Hoffman.
Yep.
Where they essentially control the news media out there and how it truly shaped public opinion and what the truth was. That's essentially what Taylor was doing.
Yeah.
Mark, you had a very good point about wanting an epilogue for this film, and I agree. The ending of it was really odd, and it just sort of stopped. Like, he finishes his filibuster, and the bad guy, Taylor, is compelled to test or to tell the truth, and then he's just Senator carried Payne, off. Rather. Senator Payne, sorry. Yeah. Thank you. Sorry. Taylor was the businessman. Yeah. So Payne, you know, says everything this man is saying is the truth. You know, I am the bad person. And then he just like collapses and then gets carried off. And then the credits roll. It's like, wait, what?
Yeah.
It ends very, very oddly and very quickly. Very so I think abrupt. An epilogue would be a fine choice.
Yeah. And I think in a modern remake, you know, which we probably won't discuss in the show because we're talking about the film now, I think they would actually include an epilogue. And I think it would be an excellent choice. I think that's just cutting it off where Capra does is, I think it's just a part of the bigger picture of Capra naivete of filmmaking. I think it basically just assumes that Senator Payne's confession, is going to mean that everything is good and well in the world and that everything works out for Jefferson Smith. But it would be nice to really see it. It'd be great to come down from that moment.
Yeah, you could even do something as like cheesy but effective as the credits roll.
Smoochie
like,
died it, on the way it. Back to his home planet.
You could do that. Or you could do a pan into the Jefferson Smith Boy Scout camp of America or whatever. You know, like you can go and have him visiting and checking that out and watching them.
Yeah, it'd be a montage.
Become the leaders. Yeah, just another montage.
We could put more eagles and flags in there.
Exactly. I'm all about that.
I don't know. I personally didn't mind the ending as it was. I kind of liked the abruptness of it, and I liked letting my imagination take the rest of that natural progression of things and form it in my own head. But I agree, it was very jarring, and I was like, "Huh, this was not what I expected."
You can't see it, but I'm raising my hand right now.
Also, good radio. Good work.
No, I was raising my hand because I wanted somebody to call on me because I was.
Jeremy, did
the
you have a question?
Recognizes the.
The senator from the distinguished gentleman from St. Paul.
Yes.
Which according one? To the.
Oh, that's right.
Uh-huh. The Swedish. No, he said the we said a distinguished gentleman, Mark.
The distinguished gentleman from the Schmidt Brewery.
There we go.
Thank you. According to the internet, the ending of the film was apparently changed at some point as the original program describes Stuart and Arthur returning to Mr. Smith's hometown where they are met by a big parade with the implication that they are married and starting a family. In addition, the Taylor political machine was shown to be crushed. Smith, riding a motorcycle, visits Senator Payne and forgives him, and a visit to Smith's mother. Some of this footage can be seen in the film's trailer.
Wow. Huh. That might have been a little bit too much. Maybe a gentler epilogue.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Huh. Interesting.
Can I also just say, what in the hell is Payne's accent?
It's British.
Was he
straight up British?
Yeah, it is. Yep. There's a hint of so that was Claude Rains. We were talking about this before we started. Who played the French captain in Casablanca, which we just talked about very recently. So you know he's kind of all over the place accent wise. But yeah, it was very much the old English American speech.
It's French Moroccan.
And, it's worth noting that in olden days, New England, they did still speak with British accents, which is kind of where the modern New England accent came from.
Yeah.
I think of how Franklin Roosevelt talked.
True.
And Eleanor Roosevelt.
Kennedy even had a bit of that. Yeah. His was sort of almost the stereotypical version of it, but yeah.
And Grace Kelly, as we discussed in Rear Window.
Yeah. Another Jimmy Stewart film.
Yep.
Nice. Good tie-in.
I think the bigger question is, what is Jimmy Stewart's accent?
It's Jimmy Stewartish.
Americana. Yeah,
it's just his.
Yep. It's that like one marble in the mouth that just sort of sloshes around a little bit. Yeah.
Pre-Andy Griffith.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think that wraps us up here. I would say overall, I think we enjoyed this movie and we were thankful that we watched it. Yeah. Anybody think differently?
I like it. 7 of 10.
Yeah. I'd give it like a 7.5, I'd say. You know, it's again, maybe that will raise as we watch more movies from this era or around that era. Maybe we'll see that this was in fact a 9 for the time. But I think it was very enjoyable. I enjoyed it.
I don't think we specified our units though. Like I would personally give it seven eagles perching on Abraham Lincoln's head.
Ooh. Oh, good call. Man. Nice. I'd give it a 45-second slow motion flag waving montage.
Ah, nice.
Yeah.
I'd give it seven governor's kids.
All the same age and all with one tooth missing, but different teeth.
I give it 6.5 highballs.
Nice. Ooh.
I nice. Give it seven 500-pound bombs out of a B-24.
Whoa.
Ooh. Wow.
Wow. Forward thinking.
That's forceful.
Because he flew a B-24 in World War II.
Ah. I just thought you again. Really didn't
like it.
Lee!
Nice.
So good.
I just thought you were really morbid.
Well, that too.
Can it be both?
Nice. All right. Well, I would say mission accomplished here. I think that we learned something, that Jimmy Stewart is, in fact, not aged forever, and that politics is always corrupt. So we got that going for us.
Yay.
So yay, Hollywood. Good job. So if you would like to find out more information about this podcast or any other podcast or blog on the Mathis Hard Network, check us out at mathishard.net. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook at username mathishardnet. There you can find show notes where we link to IMDb pages for all actors, actresses, and movies discussed here, as well as other miscellanea like that Dissolve article and some YouTube videos that we talked about. We'll try to link that up here. Our next episode will be published on Monday, March 23rd, where we will begin our remake discussion of the 1979 maybe movie Alien. So I'm super duper excited about that, and I can't wait to watch that again. I've seen it so many times and I'm just giddy to watch it again. So that's Andy's choice for our next sort of traditional episode, so good pick, Andy.
Thank you.
Until then, given that politics are corrupt and no one in space can hear you scream, may the force be with you, my friends in Jimmy Stewartdom. Go.
And also with you.
That was horrible. Oh, good Lord.